Welcome to ASAP Nowcast, highlighting the very best content from this month's issue of ASAP Now, the magazine of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the official voice of emergency medicine. I'm your host, ASAP Now Medical Editor-in-Chief, Jeremy Faust.
And we're catching up with February's edition of ASAP Now. Let's jump into the thing that was really going on right at this moment when this issue came out, which was really the worst of the COVID-19 surge right before we got the vaccines really to a lot of arms. We were just rolling it out in January and February. And one of the controversial topics that I think we had to cover was the idea of pulse oximeters at home. Do we send our patients home with COVID-19 with their own little finger pulse oximeters, or we're not sending them home out of the ED? I don't think many places were providing those to their patients, but the idea of go online, buy yourself a finger pulse oximeter, and keep an eye on that oxygen level, and that way if you're getting worse and you can come back and get some oxygen, and of course, as we learned, maybe get some steroids. Patients who have hypoxia or who need oxygen, they should definitely be getting steroids. We know from the recovery trial. And even since then, we've learned that some more expensive things like tocilizumab might actually be really somewhat beneficial. There's some benefit there in terms of a mortality benefit for patients, again, with hypoxia. So good to send patients home with a plan to monitor their oxygenation status that is something other than come back if you are blue. So the idea that I think Rich Levitan was really early in pushing for was the idea that people should go home with pulse oximeters, or they should have them as part of this sort of monitoring. And I think I've come around on this. I think there's some degree of issue that people can freak out about if they see one number go below 94 for 1 second and they rush to the hospital and they think they need to have steroids. And really, it's really about how's the patient doing overall. Of course, we all know that patients are more than their numbers. But there's an important issue that I really wanted to highlight that's related to this. And I asked my colleague, Dr. Onyeka Otugo, who's an ED doc here at Brigham and also has a master's in public health. And what Dr. Otugo wrote about for us was the issue of pulse oximetry and race with respect to the overall idea of pulse oximetry, but also COVID-19. And it turns out that these devices were really not optimized for anything other than one kind of skin color. And the problem with that is that people with darker skin colors often do not get optimal use out of these devices. And the issue is that black patients are maybe 3 times as likely to have occult hypoxemia that is not detected by pulse oximetry as white patients. That's from a study that was covered in Dr. Otugo's article. And it's, again, it's a really important point because I think that everyone should have an optimized device. So hopefully the COVID-19 pandemic has identified this as a problem that can be corrected and not just ignored. So I think it's something that I've come around on, that we ought to be maybe sending patients home with these devices, but I'm a little worried that there's an inequity there. And the best way, of course, to deal with that is to make manufacturers aware of this and start to make sure that these devices are useful for everybody. And I think that can be done. I think we've got the technology, I know we do, and it needs to be a priority. So that was our coverage of the importance of pulse oximetry at home, but also where we have really some room to improve and a place where we can advocate for everyone in our communities. Okay, let's also talk about what's on the cover of the February issue of ASAP Now. Really, as usual, always very proud to bring you this melange, if you will, of things we cover, whether it's things about practice changers. We have a new section called Practice Changers, which is being led by my girlfriend and colleague, Dr. Lauren Westifer. And Practice Changers is a column that sounds like what it is. It's a column that's really about new emerging literature that we think is going to change your practice. Not just some thing that's pie in the sky, but actually things that could change what you do in the ED. And the first iteration of the Practice Changers column was about giving patients with cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome a chance to get better with something like a butyrophenone, and that's a fancy way of saying haloperidol or droperidol. So looking at a haloperidol trial and looking at droperidol data, and I think that a lot of us are convinced that this is a good way to go, but check out Dr. Westerfer's article in the February issue. It's on page 5, but it's online, so just Google that or go to asapnow.com and check it out. Also, we teased on the front page a few other things. One of the things was a really just incredible story about an emergency physician who got into some medical trouble, to say the least, while he was overseas doing some medical work of his own a while back. Wade Wernicke wrote this just incredible story, this harrowing story of an accident when he was passing through the country of Laos, which of course, you know, how many times have I said, you know, I was passing through Laos and this thing happened to me. Unfortunately, I've not been able to travel to that part of the world and I'd love to. And this story really isn't about that per se. It's really about how lucky we are in the United States to have something like EMTALA, where you get care for emergencies no matter what, and your insurance is generally going to cover you, although we've of course covered the fact that balance billing and other issues, surprise billing, can crop up. But boy, reading this story, we realized that it's amazing to never have to worry about, is your credit card going to cover the bill when you need neurosurgery or you need spine surgery or you need something major. So this was an amazing story, and I just loved editing it. It's really inspiring. He had a really difficult recovery, but he's doing very well. And it's really a reminder that for all of us, we need to be prepared when we go overseas, to whether it's for fun or whether it's to help other people, that we need to make sure that we have the right coverage for ourselves were anything to happen. So check that out. Loved doing that one for this issue. And we also, on the cover, really the two top stories, I kind of blazed right by them, were articles about the bougie as an airway savior and another one about post-COVID myocarditis, especially among kids, for example, in the kids corner section. So please do check that out. Another article, we had a little teaser on the cover of the magazine, but we had on page 7, if you go check that out, is an article about, I love this stuff, space age technology in your hospital. And one of the things, as an editor, I'll tell you, is if you ever want to get a nerd like me interested, just talking about space, because I love stuff that has to do with space. Come on, aren't we all like a kid like that? So John Hauber pitched us this article and we loved it, and so we published it. And it's really about how space technology has over time ended up in our emergency departments. And I identify with that. Sometimes we look at the monitors and things are, they're beeping and they're buzzing and it's, what is going on? But actually it's telemetry. And telemetry is something that really did come out of the space race, if you think about it. And so we owe a lot to the space race. And there's other things coming down the pipeline which could really change the way we do things. And I think the one that excites me the most is the idea of wireless telemetry. I think that the whole thing of cords and leads and patients tied up and this and that, it's just, we all know how painful this can be. And the idea of a telemetry shirt that people can put on these jackets, take them off, and they have all the leads, that to me is the goal. And so I'm excited to see if that happens during our careers. And I think that we've come a long way with our technology. And this is another area where I think we will see improvements. But it's really cool that it came from actual space missions, things that were actually tested on the International Space Station. And I think it's exciting to think that we are doing things in our emergency departments that were actually developed by experts at NASA and around the world. So that's pretty cool. Okay, moving on. So far, we haven't done a lot of hardcore statistical breakdowns in this episode, but I think now's the time to do it. And let's look specifically at our ongoing column space called By the Numbers. And By the Numbers is sort of, I always call it our USA Today section. It's like we have a little data snapshot. We cover a lot of different things each month. We try something different. And this one is by Michael Mello over at Brown. And it's really about US motor vehicle crashes during the COVID-19 pandemic And I was blown away by these data. And these data actually caused me to do some other research when I saw this and followed up on this data, which I'll tell you about a little bit. But one thing that I think wouldn't be a surprise to anybody would be that from January through September of 2020, so before the pandemic, but really as the pandemic just blew up here in the United States, the number of vehicle miles traveled in the U.S. went down by about 15%, 14.5%. Makes sense. People were stuck at home. They weren't commuting so much. Not as low as I thought. And in fact, what happened was there was a huge decrease right at the top of the pandemic, right in the beginning, March and April. And then it really bounced back, but not back to normal. But what's really interesting is that the fatality rate per 100 million vehicle miles traveled actually increased from 1.1 to 1.35. So usually we have a pretty low rate, 1.1 deaths per 100 million vehicle miles traveled, and it went up to 1.35. So that's actually a pretty big increase when you do the math. And interestingly enough, we can bear that out. So the estimated number of traffic fatalities during this period, January to September 2020, actually went up 4.6% as compared to 2019. That blew my mind when I saw it. I couldn't believe that from January to September of 2020, there were actually more car accident fatalities than there had been in 2019. I would have bet the farm that because of the decrease in vehicle miles traveled, that people were just dying in car accidents less. And it turns out that it was momentarily true that in April and May, during the times when so many states in the United States were quote unquote shut down, or they were doing shelter in place, that there were actually about a 10.2% decrease in fatalities due to car accidents. So the estimated traffic fatalities from April and May of 2020 was actually almost 5,000, 4,845 fewer deaths during that period. But then here is the part that again just blew my mind when I saw it, that during June and July, the number of estimated traffic fatalities, June and July, went up 14.2%, or over 7,400 more deaths in 2020 than in 2019. And again, the part that just really surprised me was that, yeah, in June and July, the number of vehicle miles traveled did indeed go back up closer to normal, but actually did not get back to normal. And yet, despite the fact that vehicle miles traveled in June and July was lower than 2019, there was actually an increase in the number of deaths. Wow. That had to mean something, right? That had to mean that something different was happening with the way people were driving or the behaviors they were exhibiting. And it turns out that we actually have data on this. And the data suggests that seatbelt use during the pandemic went down from 78% to 71.6%. And honestly, that big of a difference in seatbelt use could explain a lot of it. Another thing that we also know from the data, this was not in the magazine, but I can tell you this from having poked around the data set from which these statistics come from, is that ejections went up. So the kind of car accidents that occurred were higher impact. They were more dangerous. So there were more passenger ejections from cars. There was actually more driving under the influence. So there was more drunk driving and more driving while intoxicated. Yes, again, this kind of explains why, even though in June and July of 2020, the number of vehicle miles traveled was still below seasonal normal, the actual deaths was higher. And this just, again, I'm very into this thing, as you probably know by now. I'm very into something when it goes against what I would have thought and what conventional wisdom would have thought. So this was something that we were able to cover in By the Numbers, really, just in what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, just like 5 or 6 numbers. And it tells you so much about what happened and how, when we open up our world again after the pandemic, how we gotta be safe, we gotta be careful. So maybe we have to look out for DUIs and all that kind of stuff. So please, I know anyone listening to this does not need to be told to wear their seatbelt, but go ahead, wear your seatbelt. and try not to ever drive under the influence of substances. I think that these data show us yet again what we see in our trauma bays on just about every shift, which I'm sure we all understand and agree about. And while we're covering interesting pieces of data, let's look at the benchmarking alliance section we have. This is Bringing Data to the Bedside. It's by James Augustine. He's a member of the ASAP Board of Directors and just a great advocate for so many parts of emergency medicine. Always love the chance to talk to Dr. Augustine whenever I see him in person or in a meeting, on Zoom or wherever it may be, or on the phone. And this one just shows year-on-year trends in terms of some metrics, in terms of the kinds of procedures that our patients are getting, the kinds of imaging they're getting. And I found this to be just fascinating. And the first figure, I'm going to describe it to you, it shows us two things over time. So from 2004, every year, to 2019, we've got data on how often our patients had ECGs and CTs done of any kind. So this is interesting. No surprise that our CT and ECG use went up from 2004 to 2019. I'm sure that didn't surprise anybody, but this is interesting. The CAT scans, really in 2005, you'd have 18 patients out of 100 patients received a CT scan of any kind. So 2005, starting with a baseline of 18 CTs per 100 patients, and it pretty much goes up right away for the next few years to 22, 21, the low 20s, really for the next decade. And then in about 2015, 16, it starts to go up again. And in 17, 18, 19, 2017 through 19, it actually went up. So now in 2019, it was 24 CT scans per 100 patients, up from 18 just in 2005. ECGs, an even more dramatic increase. Starting in 2004, 17 ECGs per 100 patients. And that slowly rose to 18 to 20 to 23. And then actually in 2011 and 12, it just stabilized at 26, 25. And then the last couple of years, 27, 28. So actually not a doubling, but pretty close. 17 ECGs per 100 patients in 2004, and now it's 28 just 15 years later. And I think that's because we're really conservative. We don't want to miss anything. And we always have that big safety net to rule out ACS, to rule out a STEMI. Thought it was fascinating. Also wanted to point out that the other figure that's in this great article by Dr. Augustine is some diagnostic imaging turnaround times. And no surprise, MRI takes the longest period of time. I thought it was interesting that pediatrics are a little faster, that they get a faster pediatric turnaround time than adults do. So the average MRI turnaround time in a peds ED is 222 minutes. So that's order time to the first results available. So that's your first result available. And then in adults, on average, it's 331 minutes from ordering to the first available result. Interesting, I thought as well, is that if you look at EDs by size, there's definitely something going on there. And that is that they're a little bit of a, I wouldn't say Goldilocks, because really the fastest results are actually in the smaller groups. So the 40 to 60,000 visits per year, those EDs had a turnaround time of 223 minutes. The even smaller EDs, 20 to 40,000 or under 20,000 visits per year, were hovering under 200 minutes between the order and the first result. Whereas when you get to the 60,000, the 80,000, the 100,000 visits, these are 400 minutes, 410, 414 minutes. And then a little bit of a downswing, like the really big places do a little better. It could be noise, but the real take home there is that actually in the small EDs, the turnaround time from order to first available MRI read is actually smallest. And of course the peds as well, really outpacing everybody, which makes some sense. The rest of this magazine has so much great stuff. I love the variety we're bringing you. Policy prescriptions is great, looking at homelessness and the fact that we have a lot of ED super users, frequent ED users, and how we can really do better by these patients. The end of the rainbow section about hanging up your white coat early, I think is a really good one. So for those of you who are thinking about an early retirement, love that one. And of course, there's always news from the college, and there's our ongoing feature spotlighting our residencies around this lovely country. So check out the February issue of ASAP Now in your mailbox and also on the web at asapnow.com. I will see you next month. Thanks for listening, and hope you have a good one.
ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the host and any guests. Our music is provided by Caroline Shaw and So Percussion. Thanks for listening.